Tommy McNeil. U.S. President Trump made a surprise visit to Afghanistan. AP's Ed Donahue has details.
This was the president's first visit to the scene of America's longest war.
There's nowhere I'd rather celebrate this Thanksgiving than right here with the toughest, strongest, best and bravest warriors on the face of the earth.
The president told the troops there are peace talks going on with the Taliban.
We'll see if they want to make a deal. It's got to be a real deal, but we'll see. But they want to make a deal. And they only want to make a deal because you're doing a great job.
The first stop for the president at Bagram was a dining hall. He served meals. As for eating,
I had some of the mashed potatoes, and I had a bite of mashed potatoes. And I never got to the turkey because General Milley said, come on over, sir, let's take some pictures.
About 12,000 U.S. forces remain in Afghanistan. Ed Donahue, Washington.
Iraqi security forces used live ammunition against mostly unarmed demonstrators Thursday, killing at least 40 people in one of the bloodiest days since the anti-government protests began last month. At least 25 people were killed, more than 200 wounded, when security forces opened fire on protesters who had blocked key roads and bridges in the southern city of Nasiriyah Thursday. Baghdad said it had sent military troops to restore order across southern Iraq, where protests have grown increasingly violent, with demonstrators occupying buildings and bridges and clashing with security forces who have used tear gas and live ammunition almost on a daily basis. The death toll in an earthquake-ravaged Albania rose to at least 41 Thursday, after 9 bodies were pulled from the rubble and hope faded for finding additional survivors from Tuesday's trembler, the strongest to hit the country in more than 3 decades. Authorities called off search and rescue operations after recovering the bodies of the last people who had been reported missing. It was the worst-hit town, with 23 dead. This is VOA News. Confirmation Friday by North Korea that it did test fire a super-large multiple rocket launcher, the latest reminder of Pyongyang's end-of-year deadline for nuclear talks with the United States. VOA's Bill Gallo reports.
Seoul estimates the weapons traveled about 380 kilometers before splashing into the sea. It apparently was the North's latest test of a large-caliber multiple rocket launch system. It is North Korea's 13th round of weapons tests since early May, after having refrained from any tests for about a year and a half. North Korea is intensifying pressure ahead of its end-of-year deadline for the United States to offer more concessions in stalled nuclear talks. North Korea last month walked out of working-level nuclear negotiations with the United States. It blamed Washington for the breakdown. The North has since warned it could restart nuclear or long-range missile tests.
That's VOA's Bill Gallo reporting. An ex-president, Polish president, talks to the AP about Hunter Biden and Burisma, after AP correspondent Mike Rossi reports.
A former president of Poland who is on the board of the Ukrainian gas company Burisma is defending Hunter Biden's contribution to the advisory board. Alexander Kwaśniewski tells the Associated Press Biden never used his relationship with his father, Joe Biden, to further the company's interests. The Bidens and Burisma are central to the ongoing impeachment hearings in Washington. The inquiry centers on President Donald Trump withholding nearly $400 million in military aid that was eventually released, while he pressed Ukraine's president to have the Bidens and Burisma investigated. Mike Gracia, Washington.
A former monk has died in eastern Tibet after setting himself on fire this week to protest China's repressive rule. Yan Ten, a 24-year-old former monk at Kyurti Monastery in the western China province of Sichuan, carried out his self-immolation Tuesday in a township. Spokesperson said China had imposed restrictions in the area, including cell phone use, slowing the gathering and dissemination of information about the incident. There have been 156 self-immolations across Tibet over the past decade, 44 of which took place in the same region. Germany's justice minister is calling for the country to strengthen laws on anti-Semitic crimes as part of the government's response to a deadly attack in eastern Germany. The Justice Minister Christine Lambrecht told Parliament Thursday of her planned amendment to the country's current law that would make anti-Semitism an aggravating factor for hate crimes in the nation's criminal code. Currently, discrimination against particular groups are considered aggravating factors, but the law does not specifically refer to Jews. More at VOANews.com. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
We'll be right back. Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, November 29th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The UN says Zimbabwe is on the brink of a man-made starvation.
90% of Zimbabwean children aged 6 months or 0 to 2 years are not consuming the minimum acceptable diet.
Hilal Elver is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food. Nigeria launches an online sex offender register, while activists say perpetrators rarely face justice. Namibia's Election Commission says it is satisfied with the credibility of Wednesday's polls. And Togo's embassy in Washington, D.C. begins diaspora voter registration today, Friday, but the diaspora say the conditions are unacceptable.
For instance, we say that to be eligible to get your card, you have to produce what we call card consular ID card. That is dated no less than 6 months.
Dr. Musa Isifu is the Secretary General of the United Togolese Diaspora. Botswana's worst drought in decades makes a wasteland of harvest, and experts call for an end to stigma as the prerequisite to end HIV/AIDS. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A United Nations official says Zimbabwe, once the breadbasket of Southern Africa, is on the brink of starvation, with millions facing food insecurity. Hilal Elver says the Zimbabwe government must reduce the country's dependence on imported food and increase self-sufficiency to counter effects of the struggling economy and recurring drought. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
A group of orphans in one of Harare's poorest townships, Kambuzuma, receiving their only meal of the day before they go to their homes. Opachi Washira, the founder of the charity providing the meal, Faith Community Support, says Zimbabwe's struggling economy is taking a toll. She says in the last 2 months, the organization that gives me 200 kilograms of maize meal per month has been struggling. They did not have any maize meal to give us, so we have to buy maize meal to be able to feed the children. UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, Hilal Elver, told reporters in Harare that Zimbabwe is facing its worst food shortage in years, with 60% of the population food insecure and 5.5 million people dependent on food aid.
Child deaths from severe malnutrition have been rising in the past few months. 90% of Zimbabwean children aged 6 months or 0 to 2 years are not consuming the minimum acceptable diet.
At the end of an 11-day visit to Zimbabwe, Elver said Zimbabwe was on the brink of man-made starvation.
Why I said the man-made? Something happened, not from the nature, but from the mismanagement, political and conflictual issues that bring to people starvation. It comes from dysfunctional system.
Elver called on the Harare government to increase food production to avoid shocks from the shrinking economy and recurring drought. She warned food insecurity and land mismanagement increase the risk of civil unrest. Muturi Ncube, Zimbabwe's finance minister, says the government is working to address the threat from food insecurity.
Given the drought, we need to climate-proof our agriculture. So investment in infrastructure for evacuation of water from dams is absolutely critical. That's why in the budget, you find this large allocation for agriculture.
Meanwhile, what once was the breadbasket of Africa has become dependent on food aid, and the most vulnerable in Zimbabwe, like orphans which Chuashira feeds, are left guessing when they'll get their next meal. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Southern Africa is having one of the worst droughts in years, with more than 40 million people expected to face food insecurity due to livestock and crop losses. Botswana, Lesotho, Namibia, and Zimbabwe have declared this year's drought an emergency. As Mkundise Dube reports from Botswana's village of Gamudubu, drought is so frequent that the government plans to stop calling it an emergency and instead make drought a part of the national budget.
Farmers in semi-arid Botswana are reeling after the worst drought in a decade wiped out entire harvests and left the land littered with dead livestock. Two-thirds of the crops planted last season failed, while Ngamiland, a rich beef-producing region, has recorded nearly 40,000 cattle deaths. Ranger Kaspar Matseka says there was no food or water, so his animals starved to death. Matseka says goats died and their cattle carcasses all over. He says the government should subsidize prices for stock feed and vaccines. The drought has not spared wildlife. National parks authorities have resorted to feeding starving hippos, while hundreds of elephants have died. Environmental non-government organization Kalahari Conservation Society's Neil Fit says competition for food and water has increased the risk of human-wildlife conflict.
The livestock are now putting pressure, onto the wildlife areas. So the wildlife are also getting pressure on their areas that's moving. So that is where the conflict zone is. And I'm bringing that up because it's all interconnected with the drought. Is this human-wildlife conflict?
Botswana's president, Mokgweetsi Masisi, says the government plans to make drought relief funds a part of every national budget.
Government has taken a decision to develop a drought management strategy which would classify drought as a permanent feature in our budget plans rather than an emergency. The strategy will be completed before the end of this financial year.
Acting Director of Meteorological Services, Raditupa, says a robust strategy is needed to deal with recurring droughts.
We are looking at climate change as an impact now. We are seeing the impacts now in terms of the heating, in terms of the heat waves, in terms of the dry spells, in terms of excessive rain. Therefore, we need to really adapt as a nation.
Meanwhile, a forecast for rain has raised hopes among farmers and rangers for a recovery. This season of severe drought won't be a total loss. Mkwandisi Dube for VOA News, Hamudubu, Botswana.
The chief executive officer of Namibia's Electoral Commission says the organization is satisfied with the transparency and credibility of Wednesday's general election. Theo Mujoro rejects charges that the use of electronic voter machines was aimed at rigging the polls in favor of the governing Southwest Africa People's Organization, SWAPO. His remarks came after a court dismissed a petition seeking to prevent the Electoral Commission from using voter machines during the polls. Theo Mujoro tells viewers Peter Clotty that those displeased with the outcome of the elections can use the legal system to address the concerns.
Our teams on the ground responded quite well in terms of processing or facilitating the voting process for all the voters who passed through our polling stations in the course of the day. I must also say that when you look at the turnout, the interest on the part of the electorate was quite high, which is a good indication. I think it speaks to the integrity of the process. It speaks to the fact that the Namibian population, at least the voting population, has got faith and confidence in the Electoral Commission. And I think that is why people were able to make time to join the long queues and participate in this all-important national program. So from a logistics perspective, I think we did a good job. Of course, we did experience issues here and there in relation to the technology that we deploy in the process, in relation to the mapping of our mobile teams that visited a number of places. But generally speaking, I think we are overall satisfied with the general outcome of the entire process.
When will the Namibia Electoral Commission give out or release the final outcome of the elections?
We have indicated to the Namibian nation that within 48 hours after the close of polls, we will be able to announce the official results announcement in relation to this particular election process.
Ahead of the elections, a court ruled in the Electoral Commission's favor regarding the voter machines. Some people expressed concern that the voter machines will be used to rig the elections in favor of the ruling party. Were you able to address these concerns expressed by some of these critics?
Yeah, those so-called concerns, in my view, are just mere fabrications that have got no substance and that are really unsubstantiated. We are aware that our political parties have expressed misgivings and basically showed lack of trust in electronic voting machines, and we have explained ourselves at any imaginable opportunity how the EVM works. In addition to that, we have very stringent security protocols and administrative measures in the manner that we manage these EVMs. And there is nothing untoward with the EVMs. The EVM have really enhanced our capacity to be able to, especially in relation to the counting of votes and announcements of results at polling stations. So I am aware of some of those so-called concerns, but I think we have explained ourselves thoroughly to everybody, and there is no reason why anybody should doubt the outcome of an election process that was based on voting by electronic means.
Theo Mujoro is the CEO of the Electoral Commission of Namibia. He spoke with U.S. Peter Clotty from the capital, Windhoek. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Friday, November 29. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. The Togolese Embassy in Washington, D.C. will today, Friday, embark on a three-day registration process for Togolese diaspora who desire to vote in the 2020 presidential election. This will be the first time that the diaspora will vote in an election at home. However, the United Togolese Diaspora says it wants the process suspended. Dr. Musa Isufu, Secretary General of the group, says the embassy's conditions for obtaining voter registration cards are unacceptable. For example, he says to be eligible for a voter registration card, one must produce an embassy-issued ID card dated no later than 6 months.
The way it is done, the majority of the diaspora is not ready to somehow meet those conditions, those requirements. For instance, they say that to be eligible to get your card, you have to produce what we call card consular, consular ID card, that is dated no less than 6 months as of right. The day of registration, which is something that most people in the diaspora, whether it is in Europe or America here, cannot meet. People usually go get it whenever they are traveling back home. So to make this a condition for someone to be registered to vote, we think it is really a process that is becoming difficult for people.
Let me ask you, Dr. Isifu, have you in the diaspora voted before in presidential election, or would this be the first time?
This was going to be the very first time. This is, we fought for this. We marched, we did everything, but the government did not want to do it. Finally, because I think they might have found a way to exclude people now, all of a sudden, they said, only 3 weeks ago, they said, now they have voted a law that the Togolese diaspora is going to vote. And then to vote, you have to do this. If they have told everybody that they were going to require a consular card, people would have gotten that. But they didn't say anything, knowing that they are going to require it. Within 3 weeks, they want people to go and get a card that is dated 6 months. How can we do that?
But the government, I think prior to this Friday, the government has tried to reach out to the diaspora. Why would the government want to stifle the diaspora from registering?
For those who don't know this government, you would look at them and say, these guys are up in good shape. It is not. The experience we have with this government, they have never reached out to anybody. To this day, we don't have any information as for how the legislation is going to go. We don't have any dialogue with them. We don't know what they are doing.
Dr. Isifu, as you mentioned, the registration is Friday, November 29. What do you think is going to happen if your concerns are not addressed?
We have called for a halt of this process so that things can go well, so that the government, they can do better than this. They want to do it anyway, even if they have to keep people to do it. And we are saying we are not going to be a part of a process that will lead to violence.
Dr. Musa Isifu is the Secretary General of the United Togolese Diaspora. You're speaking with us from Greensboro, North Carolina. Nigerian authorities this week launched their first nationwide register of sex offenders and held a candlelight procession in the capital, Abuja, to raise awareness and prevent violence against women. While welcome as a step forward, women's rights activists and victims of gender-based violence say Nigeria has a poor record of prosecution. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
An event in Abuja which marks the start of 16 days of activism against gender-based violence kicked off with a candlelight procession for victims at the National Women Development Center. The annual international campaign begins November 25th, the International Day recognized for advocacy on the elimination of violence against women, and runs until Human Rights Day on December 10. Earlier that day, Nigerian authorities launched the first nationwide register of sex offenders to better track perpetrators. The anonymity of the online register affords victims is a major improvement on tracking offenders, says Julie Okadonli, Director General, National Agency for the Prohibition of Trafficking in Persons.
With the Sexual Offenders Register, we have names. It's a name and shame policy. We have the names of convicted offenders, as well as names of offenders who were arrested but not convicted, for the general public to know who they are dealing with. It's very important because you have schools recruiting teachers, you have families recruiting house helps, drivers, and so on and so forth. So you want to be sure that you're not recruiting a rapist or a pedophile.
According to the United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, one in four Nigerian girls are sexually abused before they turn 18, and a majority of offenders are never prosecuted. With little faith of getting justice, most victims of sexual violence are often too afraid of stigma to report the crime. But that tide turned after hundreds of protesters in May marched against the police for detaining 65 women for alleged prostitution and then assaulting and raping a number of them. Director General of Nigeria's Women Development Center, Mary Ekpere Ita, wants tied up penalties for offenders.
Well, it's unfortunate that the custodians of the law, like the security officer, could get involved in such acts. It's very unfortunate, and I think that the law should be stiffened to ensure that such people are brought to law. I think one of the bases is that our judiciary process is slow, and judgments are not obtained on time. And because of lack of evidence at times, that the victim is still boiled down, that the victim is not speaking out.
The Nigerian police say they are investigating the allegations and have vowed to prosecute anyone found guilty. Timothy Obiezu, for VOA News, Abuja.
When HIV/AIDS was first identified more than 40 years ago, it was considered a death sentence. Since then, it has become a chronic but treatable disease. This Sunday's World AIDS Day observance is a way to make people realize that AIDS is still with us and that despite advances, the epidemic is not over. VOA's Carol Pearson reports.
Communities around the world observe World AIDS Day with messages about awareness and prevention. The simplest method is always to use a condom during sex. In 2004, when health ministers first designated December 1st as World AIDS Day, they realized that unlike other diseases, the HIV virus that causes AIDS could spread globally. Paul Kawada has been an AIDS activist since the very beginning, when people with AIDS died horrible deaths. He is still in the fight at NMAC, an organization formerly known as the National Minority AIDS Council.
And I was there in the early days. I was there when we both had to fight back and act out and also bury so many people that we loved.
Dr. Anthony Fauci has also been in the fight since the beginning. Fauci has been the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease since 1984. He's been involved in the development of treatments for HIV. Treatment is now so effective that if an infected person takes one pill a day, it's impossible to pass the virus to anyone else. 7 years ago, another drug became available that prevents uninfected people from getting the disease. It's called Truvada. Fauci says ending AIDS could be simple.
If you did those two things, treatment as prevention for those who are infected, pre-exposure prophylaxis for those who are at risk, if you implemented that to its fullest, theoretically you could end the epidemic just like that.
AIDS-related deaths are now down by more than 55% since the peak, but it's still with us. Kawada says gaps in treatment are the main reason. The majority of people with HIV in the U.S. are poor. The majority of people with HIV outside the U.S. live in low- and middle-income countries. Teenagers everywhere are at risk. They have little access to testing, health care, and counseling. And that's why Fauci says we need something else besides medication.
We're not going to eliminate HIV without a vaccine.
Fauci says the work on vaccines is promising. But right now, the best tools are still getting people tested, getting those who are positive on therapy, and getting those at risk of becoming infected on therapeutics. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports with this weekend's fixtures in the 2019-2020 CAF Champions League group stage match day one action. Egyptian champions Al Ahly will start their Group B campaign against Tunisian giant Etoile du Sahel. Etoile have a new coach in Juan Carlos Garrido and they will host Al Hilal. DR Congolese giants AS Vita Club, who won this tournament in 1973, will be away to Algerian side JS Kabylie in a Group D match, while at the Al Hilal Stadium, Sudanese giants Al Hilal Omdurman are set to play host to Zimbabwean champions FC Platinum in another Group B encounter. Five matches are scheduled to be played on Saturday, and the action will be headlined by a match between the defending champions Esperance de Tunis and Raja Casablanca. Staying with football news, FIFA has banned a leading African soccer official who faces trial for war crimes in The Hague. Patrice Edward Nagesuna was banned for 6 years and 8 months by FIFA ethics judges on Thursday for charges including discrimination and of failing to protect, respect or safeguard integrity and human dignity. He was fined $500,000. In basketball news, reigning African champions the Tigres of Nigeria will face world number one United States of America, Serbia and Mozambique in the battle for a spot at the 2020 Olympic Games in Tokyo. The Tigres opponents were unveiled at a brief ceremony midweek in Switzerland to officially kickstart the Olympics tournament qualification race. Femi Adefeso is a sports journalist and he looks at the prospect of African teams at a qualifying tournament.
Now the good part for us is USA have qualified already to the Olympic Games as world champions. Likewise, same thing for Japan as hosts. You know, so what it means is for Nigeria's group with USA, Mozambique and Serbia, USA has taken one spot. Then the three remaining teams are left to fight for two spots.
Now to table tennis. The East African Table Tennis Championships got on the way in Uganda on Thursday. Eight countries, including Uganda, have confirmed their participation. Others are Kenya, Madagascar, Somalia, Tanzania, Ethiopia, Eritrea, and Djibouti. In one of the matches played on Thursday, Ugandan player Ludia Natunga defeated Eritrea's Sarah Fashie 3-1. One of Uganda's top seeds, Regina Nakabule, says the players believe the title will stay at home.
My target is to be the best player here so that I go to Tunisia and put out my performance, because I really need to be to represent Uganda in the Olympics.
And finally, in rugby news, Kenya National Sevens team tactician Paul Feeney has retained the 12-man squad that secured Olympic qualification for Dubai Sevens and Cape Town Sevens. That's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that is it for this Friday, November 29th of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very, very good weekend.
Want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music.
and Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.